From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. She was one of the first to accuse former MSU Dr. Larry Nassar of sexual abuse. Today, we hear from Olympic gymnast Jamie Dancher.
One of the reasons why it's so scary is because we're afraid that we're not going to be believed, or we're afraid that we're alone.
Michigan members of Congress unite across party lines to fight back against reports the EPA may close its Chicago office.
This is bad news. We cannot allow this to happen. There is so much importance here in the Great Lakes states.
A new book explores the Detroit uprising of 1967 and what's happened since.
All these things happened 50 years ago, and we've yet to really seriously grapple with them.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's lawmakers are reacting to an unconfirmed report the EPA is thinking of shutting down its Region 5 office in Chicago and merging it with Region 7 in Kansas. With us now, Congressman Fred Upton, Republican from Southwest Michigan. Good to have you with us, Congressman.
Absolutely. You can call me Fred, Cindy.
Okay, Fred. What is your position on this possible closure?
Well, this is bad news. We cannot allow this to happen. There is so much importance here in the Great Lakes states, and to close Region 5, an office that has been helpful in so many different ways, keeping the Great Lakes cleaner, fighting air pollution, all those different things, to move it to Kansas, I mean, that is just not right. Just last week, I met with a number of local officials wanting to speed up a Superfund cleanup site, and it's going to take some special attention from EPA. They're able to come out and travel to Southwest Michigan. It's only a couple-hour drive. From Kansas, it would be a flight through who knows how many cities. Would you ever see these folks here? No. And thankfully, when we saw this rumor or a little bit earlier this week, I think most of us in the congressional delegation, regardless of party, Republican and Democrat, were joining together to say, no, this genie needs to be put back in the bottle. We cannot let it happen. And we're trying to send a strong signal to EPA that it's not a wise move.
Now, the EPA told our reporter Tracy Samilton that this is an unsubstantiated rumor with no merit. What are you hearing in Washington?
Well, that's how things start. And the quicker we can shut the door on this and lock it so that it doesn't escape, the better we are all off. So the reaction was the same as I talked to Republicans and Democrats in our delegation, that this is not a wise move, and the quicker we can stomp it out and not let the fire ignite something, the better off we are.
I think I know the answer, what you're going to say to this question, which is there any way that merging with that Kansas EPA office would work for Michigan in your view?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I've been a congressman for a few years now, but I worked at the White House before that. I was a congressional staffer before that. Region 5 has been a place where I've been to many times, downtown Chicago. We've been able to see their staff here in Michigan. They care about the Great Lakes. Just last week, we had the chemical spill out of the U.S. steel plant in northern Indiana, a very toxic chemical that literally closed the beaches. Not that anybody was there, but they closed down some of the water intake valves for some of our communities along southeastern Lake Michigan. EPA was there in a nanosecond. That's not going to happen if they're in Kansas someplace. You know, Dorothy may be there, but we need the EPA to stay where they are. Region 5 seems to be a pretty good central place. I know that our delegation and, frankly, the Great Lakes region would stand up to such a transfer.
Let's just talk about just a bit of context. The EPA is certainly come under attack by many in the Republican Party and your party, and the president's choice of Administrator Scott Pruitt was a man very open in his criticism of the agency. And there's been talk of a lot of significant budget cuts. Certainly, you know, the president has proposed cutting nearly a third of the EPA's budget and completely eliminated the $300 million for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So news like this, even if unsubstantiated, probably shouldn't come as a big surprise. I'm wondering how you think all of this criticism has contributed to this possible situation.
A couple things. And I worked at the budget office under President Reagan back a few decades ago. And, you know, here was a Republican president that worked well with a Democratic Congress. As we look to the future of EPA, we've only seen a skinny, what's called a skinny budget request from the Trump administration, not the line-by-line item, which is expected sometime next month. But you got to remember, this is only a budget request. It's not a budget. It actually doesn't, the process itself actually doesn't wind its way to the Oval Office for the president to sign or to veto. It's just a roadmap for the Appropriations Committee to move forward on virtually every issue. The good news right now is that Michigan, for the first time in a good number of years, we finally now have a member in the House on the Appropriations Committee. That member is John Molinar. He's got a wonderful background. If he hadn't run for Congress, he'd be the chairman of the State Senate Appropriations Committee. But he cares about the Great Lakes. At one time, we had a good number of Michigan members of Congress on both sides of the aisle on the Appropriations Committee. But really, since Joe Nolenberg a number of years ago, we haven't had anybody. And I don't think we've had anyone from the Senate from our state on appropriations in, I'm not old enough to know who the last one was. But the bottom line is that it'll be the Appropriations Committee now that determines what the level of funding will be for this important Great Lakes initiative. And our delegation, we've had a delegation meeting bipartisan about 2 weeks ago now. I think just about everyone, maybe not quite, but just about everyone in our delegation, Republican and Democrat, certainly both of our senators and a strong majority in the House chamber, we've signed a letter to the administration. We've joined forces with the Great Lakes Caucus, and we've said, no, we got to have this money. We've made a lot of progress in cleaning up the Great Lakes. We're all concerned about the impact of the Asian carp migrating from the south and somehow finding its way and threatening perhaps as big as a $10 billion tourism and fishing industry here. No, we need this money to keep our Great Lakes clean. Don't mess with the Great Lakes. Sort of like don't mess with Texas. That's what they say down there. For us, it's don't mess with the Great Lakes. Not going to happen on our watch.
Not happening?
Not going to happen on our watch. We're reaching out to members on both sides of the aisle and throughout the Great Lakes.
Because, you know, there's a lot of people listening to us talk right now who care deeply about the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and who feel strongly that the EPA needs to be strong and needs to be in Chicago. So what should they be doing right now?
Call their member of Congress. Get them on board. We need them to get their member of Congress, Republican or Democrat, to sign a joint letter to the administration and just say no. Sort of like Nancy Reagan. Just say no. Just say no, thank you. We want to keep this office in Chicago. And we want them to do their work on behalf of all of us in the Great Lakes.
Congressman Fred Upton, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
The Detroit Public Schools Community District has made its choice for its first superintendent. The school board last night voted to offer the job to Dr. Nikolai Vitti and will enter into contract negotiations with him. Dr. Vitti is currently the superintendent of the Duval County Public Schools in Jacksonville, Florida, although he did grow up in Wayne County. Aaron Einhorn of Chalk Peak Detroit is here with us now via Skype. Aaron, why did the board decide that Nikolai Vitti is the best choice to lead Detroit schools?
Dr. Vitti runs a school district that's three times the size of the Detroit Public Schools Community District. It has 130,000 students in the Duval County Public Schools in Jacksonville, Florida. That's compared to 40,000 students in Detroit, in the main school district in Detroit. It's a much bigger school district. He's actually shown some progress. Some of his numbers are moving in the right direction in that district. He's raised test scores. When the board was discussing him last night, they were talking about conversations that they had with people in Jacksonville. In fact, a couple of school board members related a story that they were at a meeting with community members in Jacksonville, and one of the fathers burst into tears, so sad that this guy was going to leave Jacksonville and come to Detroit. And the Detroit school board members said they started tearing up as well. So they spent quite a bit of time at their meeting last night talking about Dr. Vitti. And then they also talked about the other finalist, Dr. Coleman, but actually spent, you know, significantly less time talking about the local candidate.
And ultimately, it became a unanimous vote to offer the job to Dr. Vitti, who grew up in Metro Detroit in Dearborn Heights. And he went to a Catholic school. He went to Divine Child in Dearborn. So not a Detroiter and not a product of the public school system and not African American. Do you envision any resistance on the part of parents because of that?
Well, there was certainly some protest last night, and an activist who was in the room was heckling, making comments that, you know, did invoke race, and that's a concern. She said something along the lines of, you know, you all know we're Black, right? You know, and the school board is entirely African American, and so are, you know, the majority of children and families in Detroit. And you know, Dr. Vitti is white. He's married to an African American woman, and his children are of color. And he says he's going to try to enroll his children in the Detroit schools as well. So I don't know if that helps from a racial perspective. But the school board, You know, they said both candidates would have been good for the job. The comments that they were making publicly, where they were saying, you know, this is the candidate who we think can do the things for our district that we want them to do.
Interim Superintendent Alicia Merriweather is a product of Detroit's public schools. She taught, she was an administrator there, she has supported the teachers, and widely praised for having done a solid job at a difficult time of transition. Why did she not get any shot at this permanent job? What have you heard?
I'm told she was one of the 12 finalists when they were down to 12. Exactly what happened isn't exactly clear, but the board decided to include a criteria that the candidate that they move forward with have at least 3 years of superintendent experience. And Alicia Merriweather has about one, because that's when she came on board in DPS last year. And there was, of course, a lot of frustration in the community. She had the support of teachers and administrators and parents and community groups and a lot of people. There were protests at one of the superintendent interviews, you know, people saying, you know, let Alicia lead, let her proceed. I actually just posted a story about what should be the top priorities of the new superintendent based on interviews I did with Detroiters and educators. And the number one thing that everybody I spoke with for this story told me is he needs to have Alicia involved, either make her a part of his team or at least incorporate her ideas. So she's created such goodwill and such strong support in the community that if he comes in and kind of tears up the work that she's done, he'll meet with great resistance.
What you wrote about is exactly my next question. What would be some of the top priorities for him?
Enrollment has been declining dramatically in Detroit schools for years, and that causes a huge financial problem. So he's got to figure out a way to address that. And of course, you can't really address enrollment unless you fundamentally improve education so that parents are willing to take a risk. A big part of that is going to be ending the teacher shortage. The district's been trying to hire as many as 200 teachers or even more over the last couple of years and are having a very difficult time filling all the classrooms, which means that there are many, many children in Detroit schools sitting in classrooms with 40 or 50 kids because they simply don't have enough teachers. So he's got to figure out a way to convince teachers who've been in the district and left to come back, or to new teachers to take a chance on this district. One way that districts do that is money, but you know, Detroit schools may not have enough money to truly pay enough to get people to come, so maybe he's need to come up with some other ways to convince teachers.
Erin Einhorn, Chalkbeat Detroit, always great talking with you. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a new book reflects on just what has happened since the 1967 uprising in Detroit. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
As banking and the transferring of funds continues to evolve from paper to electronic here in the 21st century, let's spend some time thinking back to Michiganders in the 19th century. For them, procuring cash was way more complicated than rolling up to a nearby ATM and peeling off a stack of 20s. Without a national bank issuing currency, states like Michigan chartered their own banks with no federal oversight. And as one might imagine, without regulation, banking was quite untamed, so to speak. So soon the term wildcat banking became part of America's lexicon. With us now from the Michigan History Center is our partner in these looks in history, Mark Harvey. So Mark, in a nutshell, what was wildcat banking?
The name came from, supposedly, a bank issuing currency with the image of a wildcat on it. We don't have that in our collection as far as I've seen, so it's a great story.
Yeah.
Not 100% certain if it's true, but the term itself came from this new statehood in Michigan, lots of land speculation, and Michigan became the first state in the country to allow for free banking. So they passed the General Banking Act in 1837. It allowed banks to issue notes, not specie, like we, you know, not official federal currency, okay, but banknotes that could be used as currency, and they were. And the term wildcat, really, not all banks were bad banks or insolvent banks, but this was sort of like the sins of the few covered everybody up in the mess, and it really languished for the rest of the century in Michigan.
What did the banks have to back up their money?
Well, so there's lots of stories about that. One of my favorite stories is that there was when they were inspected by the commissioners, they would show their resources that backed the bank, and it was a box of money. But really, it was on the top was the currency, and underneath it were like nuts and bolts and other stuff. Great story. But what happened is there were some that had some resources to back their currency and some that just had none. I mean, the worst examples, they were just issuing notes with nothing to back them up.
Basically worthless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these were circulated and traded as currency, usually not at the same value as regular specie. So anywhere from 15 to 25% less value. They were introduced into Western New York and into Northern Ohio. So it wasn't just Michigan. But the real problem came when these notes, when they were redeemed, were sent back to the issuing bank.
Uh-oh.
And that's where the rubber met the road, right?
The rubber met the road.
So they either paid up or they closed up.
Ultimately, how long did this sputter along until it finally collapsed?
Well, again, it has this huge story about it. It really only lasted for a couple of years. So 1837, General Banking Act came about. The very first free banks weren't even wildcat banks. They were more normally operating banks.
And when we say free banks, what does that mean?
Free banks mean that they can generate their own, like you said, unregulated by federal government.
All
so
right.
They can generate their own notes.
So as we all know, Alexander Hamilton set up the nation's money system. This was kind of off on its own own sphere.
Right. And, you know, it's first year statehood.
Yeah.
There is rampant land speculation. So this might be a familiar story. We had rules, guidelines that said things like you could get a mortgage for the appraised value of the property instead of the market value. Ring any bells?
Mm.
So these weren't great financial decisions.
Boy, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah. And so a couple years, 1839, the Democrats did away with the General Banking Act, and they really became anti-bank. They didn't like banks. And this became a platform for the Republicans in 1854, and it really lasted through the end of the century. It was a political platform to say banks were the cause of lots of our problems.
Again, echo, echo, echo.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Right?
So these banks, any bank could print its own currency and then what, take it into town and be able to use it if I needed to buy supplies for my farm?
It was similar to what you're saying. They could establish themselves as incorporate as a bank, issue notes as currency. Depending on the community. I mean, again, this is not – we're not a huge state at this point. We're burgeoning.
We're baby state.
We're baby state. And so lots of times he's probably circulated within the community or near the borders of that community. So they didn't have a wide spread. And the same for those notes that went into Western New York and Northern Ohio. The reason those spread in there is because those states didn't have denominations less than $5. So these banks filled the void like, oh, well, you know, we got less than that. It's not worth anything, but
don't dig into that cash box too deeply.
Right.
Any other particularly poor practices that these wildcat banks leveled on consumers that we need to look at?
The one that really stuck out to me was the mortgage for appraised value and not for market value, because that, you know, that's echoes of 2008.
So it is a part of the past, and that's a good thing, but it certainly does seem like Michigan was kind of a hotbed of these wildcat banks.
They were a leader once again. Maybe we don't want to be a leader so much in this area, but we were.
Mark Harvey, our partner at the Michigan History Center. Thanks so much for taking us into the Banking Wayback Machine.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This year marks 50 years since the 1967 uprising in Detroit, and a new book reflects on just what's happened since those hot, angry 4 days in July. Bridge Magazine and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative collaborated to produce the book, The Intersection, What Detroit Has Gained and Lost 50 Years After the Uprisings of 1967. And here with me now are two of the co-authors of this stunning book, Bill McGraw, who reported for Bridge Magazine last year, and Michigan Radio's Lester Graham. So good to have both of you here to talk about this important work, because it really, really is. Lester, the book looks at the uprising and the subsequent 50 years through a number of different lenses. One per chapter?
Right. We were
basically taking a thing called the Kerner Commission and looking at the grievances by African Americans. The Kerner Commission was a presidential commission appointed by Lyndon Baines Johnson, basically look into the civil disturbances across the nation, because it wasn't just Detroit. Detroit's was the worst one, but there were dozens across the nation. Why did these happen? What were the complaints? What are the grievances? So we took a number of those grievances, like power and police and poverty and race and education and justice and housing, and we took a look at those, tore them apart, and said, okay, how was it before in 1967? How is it today? And how have African Americans in Detroit fared? And for the most part, by many measures, they're actually in worse shape now than they were before 67.
Bill, so much of this book is your reporting. That byline is everywhere. I'm wondering, what did you learn?
Well, one thing is that Detroit is so much different than it was 50 years ago. There were 1 million more people in Detroit than there are now. There were stores everywhere. That's one of the reasons there was so much looting. In every neighborhood, there was store after store after store. I also learned that, I didn't learn it, I knew it, but it was reinforced that Detroit was totally white-dominated in 1967. The black community made up roughly about 40% of the city, but they had very little political power. That's certainly one reason for the uprising. As bad as it was, the events of July 67 weren't the turning point that a lot of people have come to believe they were in the past 50 years. In 67, even though the city was in really much, much better shape than it is now, it had already been declining in a lot of ways, especially in jobs and industry, for 20 years at that point.
Starting really not too far after
World War II. Exactly. Yes. And that's been established by historians and researchers in the last 50 years. And so that's one thing that I think over the years, many people, and especially people who are like 60 or so, you have to be that old to remember what happened in 67. And I think people had come to believe this is where Detroit started turning. And that's not really true, but it certainly was a very traumatic event, and it really hurt the city badly.
Lester, in some of the segments you wrote for the book, you contrasted the state of Detroit's African-American citizens before the 67 civil disturbances and people today. And you've touched on this, but take us deeper. What really struck you?
Well, some of the things, like home ownership, for example. Mike Wilkinson did a lot of data research. He's with Bridge Magazine, and we wrote stories based on that, showing that home ownership is much lower now. There are a lot more renters in Detroit. The black middle class fled after the white fight, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and then after the 67 uprising. Black middle class finally were able to move into some of the inner ring suburbs. They were redlined before. So
South
that kind
Field
of, right,
and,
that
yes,
opened
yes.
up to them. So a lot of these things were happening in the wake of the 67 uprising. And another, you know, really horrible thing that is Detroit today, at least African Americans in Detroit today, is the poverty rate is much higher than it was in 1967. Because you had, you know, Dodge Maine, you had a lot of guys who had union jobs in the automobile industry. All those jobs went away. That left behind a lot of poverty in Detroit.
The Detroit Journalism Cooperative is actually several news media outlets working very closely together. There's Bridge Magazine, Detroit Public Television, WDET, Michigan Radio, and New Michigan Media, which includes five ethnic newspapers. Bill, this book's a compilation of writings from all those different media. What's gained by compiling all of that reporting and all that research into one book?
Well, I think most readers aren't going to be familiar with all the, especially the ethnic papers. There's the Michigan Chronicle, the Arab American News, the Jewish News, and papers that serve the Korean and the Latino communities. They obviously bring their sort of viewpoints of what happened, especially the Arab American News and the Jewish News. Arab Americans back even 50 years ago were owned stores in black neighborhoods. That, of course, became somewhat of a flashpoint over the years. And, of course, the 12th and Claremont area where the riot began was a Jewish neighborhood. In the previous 10, 15, 20 years, Jews had been moving northwest for a while. Many of the store owners were still Jewish. So there's quite a story there, I think, for modern readers about not only the evolution of that neighborhood, but the interaction between the Jewish community and businessmen and the black community. And then today, Latinos and Koreans were not a huge presence in Detroit in 67. They are a much greater presence in Metro Detroit today. They do business in Detroit. Of course, the Latino neighborhood in Southwest Detroit is very well known. So they bring their viewpoints about what's going on with their folks today.
And Lester, to have all of this in one book can pack a real punch for a reader, can't
yeah,
it?
I think that's the best thing. You know, nobody was watching TV and listening to both the radio stations and reading all of this and reading Bridge. They might have sampled some of it along the way last year, but having it all compiled into one book gives you a more comprehensive view of what we are trying to do, which is basically not look at the uprising of 1967, but to look at the state of the people then and now and see what differences were made. And that was the important part of this project.
Bill, you wrote about the terms, and we've got to get into this. Riot, uprising, rebellion, civil disturbance. Why is that important?
Well, and also remember, 67 was a summer of love.
It was. You're right.
The big question is, was it a rebellion or a riot? And, you know, in common English, I think people have referred to it for 50 years as a riot. A lot of people, though, call it a rebellion, and that started right after the last fires were doused, especially among black and white militants, that they saw this, and research has showed it's true that what was behind the events of that week were powerlessness, poverty, lack of opportunity. And so in that sense, it was a rebellion against the status quo in many ways. It also was a riot, too. Did everybody have some sort of an ideological underpinning to what they were doing that week, those who took part in it?
And when you're saying the looting, the setting fires, yeah.
Right. You know, I don't think that's true, but there certainly is evidence to back the fact that it was a rebellion. There's absolutely no doubt about it. It's been harder for many whites to sort of understand that it's a rebellion. But by thinking about it that way, I think people can get a better understanding of what happened and why there was such a huge explosion and why the explosion in Detroit was bigger than in other cities. Now, lastly, part of this, we did a poll during last year, and among African Americans today, the plurality said it was a riot. So there's really a debate that goes on between a lot of different people of what to call it.
And did I see in the book as I was reading it, and it is really good, I just want to say, having lived through it because I'm of that age, but you've brought such insight to this. And the point was made in the book, when white people are behind it, it's a rebellion, Shay's rebellion. When black people are behind it, we use the word riot, we meaning society.
Right. It happens. I mean, one of the portions of this book talks about how hard it is for people to talk about race, particularly white people. They have a hard time talking about – black people talk about race all the time. You know, it's something they have to live with, something they have to deal with. White people don't like to talk about race because it makes them uncomfortable. And so when you get down to, you know, terms like rebellion or riot, when you get down to what is white privilege, you know, it's really, really tough for most white people to talk about, to – think about. They haven't given much thought to it generally.
And to understand what was the white responsibility for what was going on in 67, 50 years ago, and what, again, is going on today.
And is that why, Lester, why we have not come to grips with the issues that really fueled this?
I mentioned the Kerner Commission at the beginning of the interview. They issued a report, and they blamed the civil disturbances across the country on white attitudes. They blamed it on white media. They blamed it on white politicians. It was an astounding book for a government-issued book at that time.
And it was ignored.
For the most part, yeah.
For the most part, right. LBJ didn't want to hear it.
No, he didn't. But anyway.
As you point out in the book, yes.
So all these things happened 50 years ago, and we've yet to really seriously grapple with them.
Bill, you were involved in the production of what is a widely hailed documentary, 12 and Claremont, with Free Press, and director Catherine Bigelow. We know will be out with a big-budget Hollywood movie, Detroit, looking at the uprising and also that incident at the Algiers Hotel where African Americans were killed. Another book coming out later this summer. With all of this attention, what do you think we might learn from what was going on in this country in 67, but particularly the uprising in Detroit?
Well, I think somebody who's really interested in what happened 50 years ago by starting with this book and going to the movies and reading the other books that's coming out, a Wayne State professor, Daniel McGuire, is writing about the what happened at the Algiers Motel, which was, of course, the worst incident in a week of horrible incidents where three young black men were killed, were executed basically for doing nothing except partying with some white girls, basically. We haven't seen the movie that's called Detroit by Catherine
Bigelow. The new trailer is out.
The trailer is out, and it's pretty dramatic. And she's done two very good movies. I'm really interested in seeing that to see how closely that sticks with the facts as we know them. Of course, the book, the story of the Algiers was written by John Hershey, published in 68, I believe. So it's a way of informing yourself, Riot, the Rebellion, was certainly one of the top most important events, one of the top five most important events in Detroit's history. So I found in working on the movie, among younger people, there's a lot of interest in what happened. They're not even aware that, like, say, the U.S. Army was called in, that Johnson was addressed the nation twice that week about Detroit. So there is a lot to learn.
The significance of the title.
Intersection, well, it's 12th and Claremont. So, you know, that's why we call it an intersection. That's why the project was called that. I want to say something, though. Bill did write a good deal of this book, and I think he did a masterful job. But the most impressive thing is this story called The Blind Pig. It's chapter 8, and he talks about the man who just very well might have thrown the first bottle in this riot and where he went in life, where his son and went in life. And it's really just a fascinating story. So that's something you should not miss.
And I think those who are too young to remember should know that what we today call Rosa Parks Boulevard was 12th Street, named after it. It is really a powerful book and really commendations to everybody involved in it. The intersection, what Detroit has gained and lost 50 years after the uprising of 1967, out from Bridge Magazine and the Detroit Journalism Cooperative. Bill McGraw, of course, writing for Bridge Magazine. Lester Graham with Michigan Radio, two of the book's co-authors. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump's proposed budget contains big cuts to programs that are not about defense and the military. One of the programs on the Trump chopping block, the Community Development Block Grant Program, slated to be completely eliminated under this proposed budget. Oakland County Treasurer Andy Meisner is in a position to know just how that would affect communities and people. And he's here with us now. Andy, what did you think when you first heard of the president's proposal?
I was concerned. There were a lot of elements of the budget that I was very concerned about. But elimination of the Community Development Block Grant was one that really struck me as being counterproductive. You know, community development protects property values. It helps us fight blight, helps us stabilize a lot of the neighborhoods that were hit hard during the recession. And, you know, right in Oakland County, you know, we have a lot of communities that are benefiting from the Community Development Block Grant. You know, Madison Heights and Oak Park are using it for code enforcement. You know, and code enforcement is really kind of the front lines against blight and blight-related loss in property values. Rochester Hills, Southfield, Troy, Pontiac are using it for independent living for seniors. And some communities are also supporting Haven, which is our domestic violence shelter. And so it's a very flexible tool. And it struck me that, you know, it's a federal budget. It's large. There are certainly areas that can be cut and shrunk. But it seems to me that we should invest in strategies that provide a good return on investment. And the Community Development Block Grant is just one of those.
I think that for a lot of us, that term block grant is just kind of there.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of us realize the very many ways it's used and really within people's homes where it really makes a difference in people's lives. It's not just some thing that some government money somewhere.
Yeah. And it suffers from a very bureaucratic sounding name. And
yeah.
By the time you say block grant, you know, people's eyes have glossed over. But yeah, you know, I mean, to describe it in other words, you know, it's a chunk of money that the feds give to the states. And then the states can give to the locals. And the beauty of it is that the local government gets to decide what the best use is within a certain set of parameters. So, for instance, they might find that public services like childcare, job training, or services for seniors is a worthy cause for use of these dollars. You know, if they're like Oakland County and our county seat of Pontiac, that had quite a few foreclosures during the crisis, they might find a benefit in renovating and rehabilitating some of those properties so that new families can move in and help stabilize the neighborhoods. And so it's this very diverse tool that really plays to local prerogatives. And of all the things that I would cut in the federal budget, this is not one of them.
Well, this strikes me as exactly the kind of thing the president said he wants to see more of. Let's take power away from Washington and put it in the hands of local government.
That's a great point. And that was more of a Republican philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
My time working on Capitol Hill in the 90s, I saw the Congress really shift in that direction to the block grant approach, thinking that the locals know better. And, you know, these days that's probably true. But we also saw that in law enforcement grants that were block granted more. But it does give the locals a lot of flexibility, and it's not a place that I would cut. I think it could be refined. Like any program, there are ways to make it better, to focus more on the performance measures and what value the strategy is generating. But if you look right in Oakland County, you know, we see some real practical results of it that are boosting our property values and helping to make Oakland County a very attractive place to live.
Even for supporting seniors. I mean, my goodness, the array of services that block grants helps to help seniors stay in their homes or make it more comfortable in senior residences.
Yes. I mean, chore services like mowing the grass or cutting the lawn, shoveling the snow, getting a ride to a doctor's appointment. We know that these elements that allow seniors to stay in their home help them live longer lives, healthier lives, and happier lives. And that is yet another benefit of the Community Development Block Grant Program. And so that's a real difference maker. And, you know, we have to take care of our seniors. And a lot of our communities are doing that with the benefit of this program.
So what do you think it would look like if the president's budget is passed without Congress changing it? And if indeed block grants are wiped out, what would that look like on the ground?
Well, here's the problem is that will result in lower property values, less stabilized neighborhoods, blight that is going to be able to fester and grow. In Oakland County, our taxable values took a hit of $14 billion from foreclosure-related blight. And those days are going to come back. And another part of the problem is that it's not just the Community Development Block Grant on its own. The Community Development Block Grant interacts with a number of other funding streams from the local, state, and federal level that are geared at protecting property values, stabilizing neighborhoods. And so the other piece is that we're going to lose that synergy that exists with, like, for instance, the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, some of the hardest hit funds that were used for demolition. I know that in Pontiac, you know, they've used a number of these different funding streams for their community development strategy. And so the ripple effect of eliminating this program would be much greater than just the footprint of this program in particular.
And I know you've been pretty much shouting from the rooftops trying to pass the word about how block grants help communities, including writing to Housing and Urban Development Secretary Dr. Ben Carson.
Yeah.
Are you getting responses? Are you getting any reaction from Washington?
You know, I don't think I'm very persuasive because you're right. In December, in a act of bipartisanship and outreach, I did write an open letter to Dr. Carson talking about the importance of the Housing and Urban Development Department. And I actually singled out the Community Development Block Grant as a particularly effective tool. And so then the fact that the budget came out after that without it, you know, I'm wondering exactly how persuasive my arguments were. I think maybe I need to sharpen the pencil a little bit.
So what do you think it will take, Andy, to convince Congress to not give the president what he wants here?
Well, and that's really the bottom line is that we need a call to action. And we need our constituents to reach out to our members of Congress. There are some that get it. Senator Peters and Congressman Kildee are two that have been really out front in this area. They get it.
Yeah, but they're not in the majority.
Right, but that's who we really do have to call our majority members. You know, we have to give Congressman Bishop and Congressman Trott a call and say that, hey, this is working in your district right now. And, you know, the president's budget is important, but a lot of times I've seen my days working on the Hill where it would land on Capitol Hill with a thud. That thud presents an opportunity for us to influence the process, and we need to make our voices heard. And, you know, I encourage people locally to ask their mayor or city council and say, hey, you know, do we get any community development block grant dollars, and are we using these? And I think that they're going to find that they are being used in their local communities in ways that really affect their house, their neighbor. services in their local neighborhood. And you can't say that about a lot of federal programs that have that reach and have such an impact on our property values and our tax base.
Oakland County Treasurer Andy Meisner, thanks so much, Andy.
Thank you.
Four more of his former patients are suing ex-Michigan State University sports doctor Larry Nassar for charging him with sexual abuse, and that includes a 14-year-old dancer. Meanwhile, an Ingham County judge recently issued a revised gag order that bars witnesses named in one of Dr. Nassar's criminal trials from speaking publicly. There are now more than 80 other women and girls claiming the former MSU doctor abused them under the guise of treatment. One of the first to accuse him of sexual abuse is Jamie Dancher of California. She was a member of the bronze medal-winning American gymnastics team at the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. Jamie Dancher is here with us now. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you.
Jamie, how did you feel when you had first learned that a Michigan judge had ruled that you couldn't talk about what happened to you?
Disbelief. I'm still really disappointed. I feel like I can't talk to anybody about this, including my parents or my family or my friends. It was so hard to come forward and speak up in the first place. And now feeling like I can't even talk about it with my own family, it's definitely a shock. And it feels unfair. It doesn't feel right.
Did you have a sense, too, that that gag order might keep others from coming forward?
Absolutely. One of the big reasons why I decided to speak up is because there are more survivors out there, you know, from even more recent Olympic teams. I wanted to speak up to make them know that they're not alone, so they can speak up. And to have this be so scary from the start, to go public and be on TV and start talking about this, it was very empowering to speak before the senators. And to feel like I was making some change along with some of the other survivors, and to hear that I think over 100 women have now come forward, and then to all of a sudden be told, like, now you can't talk about this anymore. It doesn't feel right to me.
Jamie, when and how did you first encounter Dr. Nassar? How old were you?
It was somewhere around 12 or 13 when I was introduced to Dr. Nassar.
Can you give us an idea of what kind of interactions were going on and at what point you realized that this wasn't right?
When I made the USA Junior National Team and I was introduced to him, my hips started going out of alignment and it was causing me severe back pain. You know, Dr. Nassar was always really, really friendly, made me laugh. He was actually one of the more positive adults around. Over time, his procedures became more invasive. Honestly, it wasn't until July of 2016, last year, that I realized that this was sexual abuse.
As you testified last month at that congressional hearing, it was very stunning. You say this abuse happened all over the world, and you always thought you were the only one.
Yeah, I didn't understand. I trusted Dr. Nassar. I didn't think about it in any other way except medical treatment. I mean, he would tape my ankles and treated other injuries as well, so I didn't know what he was doing was wrong.
And there you were, one of the very first to step forward to accuse him of sexual abuse. Why did you do that, and what happened when you did?
Once I realized it was sexual abuse, I knew that there were other victims. Rachel Denhollander was speaking up as well. What kind of happened with me, it was definitely scary. You know, I told my parents, I told my mom actually for the first time what happened. I didn't know if I was going to go through with it or wanting to speak up publicly. But when I looked at my nieces and, you know, thought about that happening to one of them, I decided this isn't right. What he did was sexual abuse, and I want to speak up so other survivors can come forward, and I want to protect as many people that I can, all the other little girls, you know, that I've coached over the years as well. I didn't feel right about being silenced anymore, because I didn't want this happening to anybody else.
So I can only imagine your feelings as more and more women, so many women, step forward to say, yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's definitely been the start of my healing process. When I first came out, to be honest, like, people in the gymnastics community didn't believe me. They said awful things about me. Some even harassed me. They attacked my character on social media. It hurt to see that. I mean, some people that were attacking me were people I thought were my friends. That was hard, but I knew in my heart what he did was wrong.
Jamie, has that changed since so many other women and girls have said, you know what, he did the same thing to me?
Oh, yes, of course. That was one of the main reasons why people, I don't speak up. You know, obviously, like, little girls aren't going to speak up. Women speak up. One of the reasons why it's so scary is because we're afraid that we're not going to be believed, or we're afraid that we're alone. To have so many women come forward and know that there are so many more has definitely been empowering. And to have it be taken away right now is not okay.
Throughout the time period in which women like you have come forward saying that Dr. Nassar abused them, he was employed by Michigan State University. What are your thoughts on just how the university's administration has handled this entire situation?
I didn't know at the time that Dr. Nassar was actually being paid by MSU. I wonder if MSU has policies in place that require doctors to obtain consent from parents before performing these invasive procedures on children. And if so, why weren't they enforced? Why didn't MSU, when they investigated Dr. Nassar in 2014, why didn't they tell USA Gymnastics? Why didn't they report that to USAG? Maybe USAG could have taken action sooner and saved more survivors from being abused by Dr. Nassar.
Jamie, what would you like to see from the administrators at Michigan State University that you haven't seen yet?
Maybe some accountability. That would be nice. Since he was an employee there, and I feel like nobody wants to be accountable or responsible for Dr. Nassar at all. Like, who was responsible for him? If he was employed and being paid by MSU, then shouldn't they take some accountability? Maybe some compassion for the survivors, which I haven't seen that either. Not only, like, that's what I mean, like, to have a judge issue a gag order saying we can't even speak, especially coming from another woman. You know, that just doesn't sit right with me.
What would justice look like for you in all of this?
Number one, to be able to keep talking about it and speaking up about it so that more women and young women and even children that it's happening to right now, to be able to keep talking about it, keep empowering these women that they can speak up, they can talk about it, and they should. Obviously, I think Dr. Nassar is going to be going to jail for a very long time. Sorry, like, I don't know what justice really looks like. I just know that I want to keep helping women heal by being able to talk about this and telling them that they're not alone. And I want to keep trying to make change and put in stronger policies and putting in the right people at USAG to protect the children and the future of not only gymnastics, but youth sports.
Jamie, would you want a niece or a daughter of yours to pursue gymnastics now?
Yeah, I think that's why I'm doing this. I love that my nieces do gymnastics. And, you know, if I ever have a daughter of my own, if she wants to do gymnastics, I want her to do whatever she wants to do. I want them to feel safe. You know, I want them to be as protected as they can be. And that's really why we're speaking up about this is, you know, I can't get my childhood back and what happened to me, but I can help other women not feel alone and come forward. And I really feel like these changes that we're trying to make are going to make gymnastics safer and youth sports altogether.
Jamie Dancher, Olympic gymnast who was one of the first women to accuse former MSU sports doctor, Dr. Larry Nassar, of sexual abuse. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your story and speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
One final note, I certainly hope you'll join me when we take to the road for a live Stateside show this Saturday evening, April 22nd. We'll be at the Flint Institute of Arts, and we want you to be part of the live audience for the show. You can find out more by just going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Hope we'll see you on Saturday evening. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.